And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Brian Cannard about Steinbeck, Citizen Spy. And we've been kind of detailing, of course, some of his early history involvement from the OSS to the CIA, him working as a spy during the Second World War and everything else. Before we carry on and get into like Operation Mockingbird and, you know, all these interesting things that goes on with the CIA connection to, you know, the media and you know, plays and movies and everything else, how much do you think, if you look at his literary work, Steinbeck's literary work, how much of that have been on, you know, they've ordered the work basically and said, you need to write about this or you need to get into that topic? Or was he pretty much free to reign as he wanted to? I know that that's a difficult question to ask you, but what do you think? No. What's your perception?
Well, I think most of Steinbeck's novels, with the exception of one, The Short Reign of Pepin the Fourth, had nothing to do with the agency whatsoever. That being said, we also have to remember that Steinbeck was a very prolific journalist. And Steinbeck worked, of course, for Collier's, but he also worked for the Louisville Courier-Journal, the New York Herald Tribune, also the Saturday Evening Post. All three of those are implicated by Carl Bernstein in his 1977 article, The CIA and the Media, as having ties to the agency. So one has to wonder, Steinbeck keeps writing for these organizations that have ties to the agency. Is that happenstance, or was it CIA directed? And I think if we look back, once again, the quintessential 52 trip, there are three articles specifically that Steinbeck writes for Collier's that I think were written on spec, or at least two of them. One was called The Soul and Guts of France, and was actually, Collier's ran it 10 days before the first meeting of the European Parliament, which of course was the precursor to the EU.
Yeah.
And in The Soul and Guts of France, Steinbeck visits the wine country in southeast France and is invited there by an English teacher who loves Steinbeck's works. And if reading this, it's the most un-Steinbeck thing Steinbeck ever wrote. He talks about how squalid the living conditions are and how the kids there go around without shoes, but their parents scraped up enough money to shod their children before the great American author comes, and actually calls them peasants. And for the guy that wrote The Grapes of Wrath, from reading this, it seems like two different people. I mean, you would think that from this perspective, Steinbeck would have written The Grapes of Wrath as if the Jodes deserved what they got because they didn't keep up with their loan payments.
Right.
But the tagline is, for that article, is, what can we expect from our French allies? Here's an illuminating answer. Not from the mouths of politicians, but from the tough individualistic farmers who once terrorized the Germans. So it's being written in a perspective of, we really don't need to write off the French. They're so backwards that they need America's help. In 52, funds for the Marshall Plan are dwindling. So we have a situation where Steinbeck is writing an article, basically a pro-Marshall Plan article, to put that idea in the American public's head that we need to keep funding Europe.
Yeah.
And Steinbeck also talks about Matthew Ridgway in this article and another one, A Duel Without Pistols, which happens when he travels to Italy a few weeks later. And Steinbeck's trip corresponds with Ridgway's travels. And Ridgway had just replaced Eisenhower as the head of NATO. And Ridgway was not very popular with the French, and because of some statements that he made at the beginning of the Korean War about the efficacy of the French army. So the French hated Ridgway, and Ridgway filled the NATO upper ranks with primarily American officers and didn't really get a good representative sampling of European countries. So Ridgway's pretty much hated. There are riots in Paris over Ridgway being there, and Steinbeck actually stays in the same hotel that Ridgway stays at when he's in Rome a few weeks later. But Steinbeck defends Ridgway through these two articles. So we have a number of moving parts going on here. But from the tenor of the article, it's very obvious that this was something that I don't think Steinbeck would have written on his own. I think he was more or less either directed to a topic or directed specifically to cast the French in this light so the American public would once again decide, yes, we still need to stay involved in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. So this is to justify that. Is that the only... I found another interesting kind of connection, I guess, through the Nobel Prize as well, because Linus Pauling received that in as the Peace Prize in 62, and that's the same year, by the way, that Steinbeck receives it in literature, and they're both up there at the same time. But there's this weird kind of interesting connection through something that you brought up called the HT Lingual Program, I guess they called it, right? They actually opened people's letters and monitored them and everything else. But Linus Pauling was one of the people that they monitored with that. Yeah, which is just kind of interesting and coincidental, perhaps. I don't know.
I don't think it's coincidental because, let me get into one more thing real quick. I did not cover this in the book because I don't have enough evidence to really talk about this in print. But Steinbeck's Nobel Prize was kind of controversial.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, even this year, the Nobel Committee had to, talk, basically it's an ongoing controversy. They have to draw up to every year practically and try to justify it in different ways,
Well, exactly. And there has been rumblings that the previous year's literary recipient was Saul Bellows and the CIA rigged that. Now, I'm not saying that I don't want to diminish Steinbeck's literary works by saying that the CIA arranged for the Nobel Prize, but it's not outside the realm of possibility.
No, certainly not. I mean, look at the history of the whole, I consider it a debacle. The whole thing is just a big sham,
Yeah.
When Obama gets the Peace Prize, that's the nail in the coffin right there. So,
yeah, I cringed at that one. but you mentioned Linus Pauling, which is interesting because Pauling does show up in the book. And Steinbeck's last great service for the CIA happened 6 or 7 years after he died. In 1975-76, the Church Committee hearings were happening here in the United States. And this is all fallout from Watergate. The CIA tried their very best to stay out of the Watergate scandal and pretty much did. But there were a ton of journalists that were still digging into, did the CIA know about Watergate? Did they, supply support? And Seymour Hersh, who was a journalist, well, actually still is for the New York Times, broke a story about the Family Jewels, which was a series of CIA documents that were drawn up after Watergate happened to kind of vet what all the CIA's past sins are. And we know about things like the Phoenix Project, MK Ultra, and Mockingbird, specifically from the Family Jewels.
Mm-hmm.
So when this came out, of course, the country was up in arms about Watergate, and they're still up in arms against the CIA with this revelation. So the Church Committee goes in and tries to clean house within the agency. One of the operations that's mentioned is HT Lingual. And that was a mail opening campaign that happened. Once again, it's kind of hard to tell the years, but at least from the early 50s on to the mid 70s, where the CIA at first, when they drew up a watch list of people that had ties to Eastern Europe or to communist countries, and they would copy the address information on the outside of their envelopes. That morphed into actually opening their mail. And Steinbeck was the subject of that HT Lingual program. Jesus Joseph Angleton testified to Congress, or to this committee rather, and was directly asked by Walter Mondale why Linus Pauling, Steinbeck, and Victor Ruthers of the Auto Workers Union were targeted. And in other testimony at other times, we have a publisher by the name of Frederick Prager show up, and other people. A member of the Rockefeller family was mentioned too, mm-hmm. as being part of this mail opening program. Well, if we look into some of these people that they mention, Victor Ruthers was involved with the CIA in setting up unions in Europe that were sympathetic to the CIA and had membership that would rebuff any inroads that the Communist Party might make in to those unions, because that's an easy vector for communists, or was back then. Frederick Prager, who there's a link in the book with Prager and Steinbeck, but Prager was an intelligence officer during the Second World War, and later his publishing company produced 20 or 30 books that were sold to the CIA. And he was friends with Dulles. And there's evidence in Dulles's files that are available, I believe, through Princeton, of some letters that passed back and forth between Dulles and Prager that denote a pretty close relationship between them.
Right.
So in this list, and the Rockefellers too. The Rockefellers have been involved in the intelligence community since World War II, at least. So we've got a majority of these names that are given up to Congress as people that were already involved in with the CIA. So during this questioning, Angleton is asked about these people, and his answer is he'd prefer to respond to that question in executive sessions. And Mondale asked him, well, do you believe national security can be protected through the sacrificing of these rights? And Angleton answers, I believe that all matters dealing with counter-espionage require very sophisticated handling and require considerable latitude. Well, what the CIA has done right here is they've given up some sacrificial lambs to the public, but in closed session, Angleton can go back and say, Senator Mondale, John Steinbeck was working with us, Victor Ruthers was working for us, Frederick Prager was working for us. They're all assets. We were doing this as counterintelligence. Their rights were not violated because we wanted to make sure that our assets were pure and they were loyal to this country. So it's a classic smokescreen. I mean, it's kind of a sleight of hand, because nobody's going to bat an eyelash at any of these people because, oh, well, you know, that kind of makes sense. You know, Linus Pauling, of course, would develop weapons during World War II. And out of all these people, nobody really cared about it that much except for Pauling. Pauling was pretty pissed that his mail was being opened and spent about 10 or 11 years trying to get answers to why he was targeted, never really got them.
Yeah. What do you think about in terms of controlling, try to control Europe after the Second World War here, and what the efforts were? Because, of course, a lot of money went into it with the Marshall Plan, and they saw that as an opportunity to, you know, to guide, I think, all the countries in the continent, you know, in the way they wanted to. And of course, at the same time, there is a real and present, you know, danger with the Soviet Union right there. I mean, they had, I think, Wiesner, when he was over there, he learned that the, you know, the Soviet Union were planning to take over as much of Eastern Europe that they could, you know, so it's a real clear, viable threat. But what happened with the CIA that I find interesting as well is that they were kind of surfing the wave, if you will, of the movements that were going there already. They were anti-communist, but they weren't necessarily anti-lefty or anti-socialist, because a lot of the, you know, people that they funded and were part of the operations under Mockingbird and everything else were very much in the democratic socialist, you know, kind of environment, if you will. So what I saw when I started looking into this a little bit more, with all the magazines that was controlled, and, you know, a lot of them were, you know, pro-liberal as well, it was more that the CIA doesn't really necessarily perhaps care what political system is in place, as long as they are in a position where they can control the players. And if the political structure is such that it's easier to control it with a, let's say, through a bureaucracy and indirect through the right people, as opposed to a, you know, clear full-on dictator, as in, you know, as in the Soviet Union, it's gonna work in their favor, and they're gonna kind of just keep the country, or you know, the sentiment of whatever is going on in the country, they're gonna keep people pleased with that, if you know what I mean. What do you make of this?
I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, we see situations where in Marseille, and this was in the early 50s, there was a huge dock worker strike that happened, and Marseille, of course, most of the weaponry that was going from France to Indochina went through the Marseille's port. Well, the port was shut down, so that hampered the French holding on to Indochina or Vietnam at the time. So the CIA comes in to kind of clean things up. And you're right. It wasn't so much that they cared about what the political ideology of the dock workers were, as long as they were paid well enough and treated well enough that they kept the supply of weapons going.
Yeah, yeah.
And you also run into another problem when we talk about control, too, because there's two sides to this coin that the CIA is playing at this point. The reason I titled the book Citizen Spy is because Steinbeck was one of thousands of American citizens that were used as intelligence assets during the Cold War. My CIA contact called them walk-ins. And what these people would do, and this includes journalists, aerospace engineers, whoever, businessmen, who would come to the CIA and say, "Hey, I'm going to be going to this conference. What can I do for the agency?" And we're talking about a pool of people here that are part of the Greatest Generation, where 10 to 15% of American males were in service during World War II and have some specialized skill sets. The CIA is underfunded at this time. They're making it up as they go along, because never before in American history has an intelligence apparatus been put in place that's responsible for monitoring intelligence throughout the entire world.
Yeah, exactly.
So they had to use citizens to gather intelligence.
Piggyback on any movement that they can, you know, all of these things that it gets out of the realm of apolitical ideology at this point. It ends up being about maintaining control, and do that with any means necessary, right?
Right. And not only that, but getting the intelligence at all costs.
Yeah.
Because that's what the key is. It's, you've got to know what your enemy is doing and stay two steps ahead of them. And if you don't have the apparatus in place to do it, you fake it till you make it. And that's what they were doing at that point. And that's why people like Steinbeck were so important to them, because Steinbeck crossed all sorts of cultural and political boundaries. Steinbeck would talk to everyone from, once again, those dock workers in Marseille, to French Air Force generals. There's during the 1952 trip, he was invited to a party that a French Air Force general threw in Algiers. And suddenly Steinbeck's travel plans change from going to Greece to heading to, oddly enough, Marseille and to Spain after that one party. So we have little instances like that where people like Steinbeck were not tasked with, you know, the James Bondy stuff of what we think of as spies and intelligence, but right. simply keeping their eyes and ears open.
Just in case something comes up, if it, because anything, no matter how small it can be tremendously useful, right? In the, as you're trying to piece together that puzzle about things you don't know. So
yeah.
anyone they can use anywhere, they would be on that, you know?
Yeah. Well, think about this. And this is an example I use in the book that's based on an example my CIA guy gave me. Say we have a businessman that's in Portugal that's on the CIA payroll. He goes to his local pub that night and there's a manager of a tungsten mine. Who's complaining that one of their mine shafts fell through and their production's going to be down 15% over the next quarter. Well, it just so happens the Soviets bought tungsten from this Portuguese mine to make rocket nozzles. So that means that the production of Soviet rockets is going to be down a certain percentage. And that's just loose talk that anybody in a non-sensitive or non-classified setting might just throw out there to the world.
Yeah.
An analyst back in Langley puts all those little pieces together and those little dots. And that's how the agency gets an aggregate picture. And once again, we're talking about thousands of people. And the Mockingbird angle, it's hard to tell exactly where that type of activity or the citizen spy activity transforms from keep your eyes and ears open to, all right, we really need you to plant this story.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and of course the CIA isn't coming off of any records on that. And we have Carl Bernstein to thank for his sources that have gone on the record to talk about this. But still, there are not really many operational details. And as a result of the Church Commission, and this is another interesting distinction that my CIA asset gave me, was after the Church Commission, the journalists were off limits for CIA recruitment. So the CIA can't go to a journalist now and say, hey, will you work for us? But a journalist can volunteer to work with the CIA, and foreign journalists are not out of bounds either, which I always thought that was kind of a light bulb to me too. I thought, well, crap. Yeah. Why wouldn't the CIA have foreign journalists on their payroll?
Yeah.
Because journalists they're inquisitive. They have access to places and people that normal civilians don't. And a journalist nosing around something is not going to arouse any suspicion.
Yeah.
Whereas, you or me or a tourist would. So it's a brilliant ploy, but it is so difficult to tell where the intelligence gathering stops and the propaganda spin begins.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point. And we've seen the same with celebrities, and that, you could put Steinbeck kind of in that category in between there then, in a sense, but the use of celebrities have been very efficient to get people to, pass through borders without checks and, carrying in some cases material, in other cases just information. And there's a number of these cases that have been coming out about, people who work for the agency, and it might not be a big deal to them or whatever, but it's tremendously important in the bigger picture for the CIA.
Well, and it still goes on today.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this came out, I believe, last year, that a New York Times reporter had caught wind of a piece that was being written about the CIA and the bin Laden capture kill. And the CIA was interested, and this in that piece and was interested in what it said. And this reporter actually emailed his CIA contact and said, there's nothing that you guys need to worry about, but delete this email. And the New York Times ended up having to apologize for that once it became public. So that those type things are totally unethical. But, you know, and you take the flip side of that too. If a journalist knew about the bombing of the USS Cole in 2000 and didn't tell the proper authorities, you know, that's something that they should have done. And I'm not saying that happened. It's just an example of what their ethical obligation would have been if they had a piece of actionable intelligence.
Right.
But yeah, it's hard to tell, but you have to wonder about people like Dennis Rodman going to North Korea.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
What the hell is that about?
Yeah, I know. It's so bizarre, you know, so bizarre.
But we go back to Steinbeck too, and we talked about the counterfeiting scheme. Steinbeck retooled that, and Collier's published an article called "The Secret Weapon We Were Afraid to Use." You know, and the tagline was, FDR loved the idea, the Brits hated it, will we be so timid as to not use it again, or something like that. Well, and basically it's a fictionalized story about dropping fake currency over a Iron Curtain country. And Steinbeck tells a little bit about, you know, his interactions with FDR and the Secretary of Treasury at the time. And oddly enough, 6 months later, after this article's published, you remember the song in the 80s, 99 Red Balloons by Nina?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Big hit, Tim.
Big hit, but also was based on a CIA operation that floated fake kroner notes into Czechoslovakia using weather balloons. And these fake bills, which were very, very good reproductions of the krona, had propaganda statements on it, you know, to the effect of, what have the Soviets done for you guys lately? You know, throw off the shackles of your communist oppressors and, you know, take back your country. So that's, you know, 4 to 6 months after this article's written. So was Steinbeck kind of salting the mine at that point by telling the Soviets, hey, you know, I can almost convince them to do it again, and, you know, they might be looking at it, and then doing this? And we see things throughout the Cold War, like the Star Wars or SDI program. How much money did the Russians waste on that? And that was a total ruse. The XB-70 bomber, there were two of those produced, and one of them crashed on a test flight. But the Russians produced 1,500 or 1,600 MiG-25s to specifically combat that threat that never existed. So you have to wonder, are these games that Steinbeck is involved in? And once you start connecting the dots, it's totally plausible that, yes, it was. And the one book I talked about, The Short Reign of Pepin the Fourth, is Steinbeck's only political satire piece. And it was written in the mid-50s and published in 56 or 57. And we have to remember that France during this time period was totally unstable. I mean, from the end of World War II until, you know, 1960, I think there was something like 23 different changes of government in France. And of course, they ended up bailing out of NATO, which was the Americans' fear all along, that France would turn hardcore communist right in the center of Europe. And that would be a huge problem. Well, Steinbeck writes this political farce about, once again, another failed French government. And everyone's sitting around going, all right, what are we going to do now? All the movers and shakers of France. And they decide, well, heck, let's reinstall the monarchy and we can tear it down and we'll all look like big heroes when the monarchy fails again. I know.
Look at that. Yeah, interesting.
But it was a bestseller in France and also has the return of a Merovingian king to the throne of France.
Interesting. The occult, more esoteric angle to that story then, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't have thought so. And I would have thought, all right, Brian, you know, you've been writing in the Grail Seekers blog too long. You know, really, this is not a Dan Brown novel. But when I talked to Thomas Steinbeck in 2008, since we were talking about the Holy Grail, of course, the Da Vinci Code came up. And Tom, just out of the blue, says, you know, my dad never really believed in the Priory of Zion. I was like, how did he know? And he said, well, he was, you know, hooked in with, you know, scholars and politicians, and he just knew about it. And I remember him distinctly, us talking about it, and he didn't believe it. This is kind of difficult because the Priory really didn't become public knowledge until Gerard de Sade's books on the subject come out in the late 1960s. And then they're kind of a flop in France at the time. And Steinbeck didn't read French that well anyway. So what we're talking about here is during the exact same time that Steinbeck is writing The Short Reign of Pepin the Fourth, Plantard and his priory are registering with the French government. I mean, during the same years, this is when Steinbeck is living in France for a number of months too.
This is like 60, when is it, 64 or something?
Well, yeah, he was there in 52, 54, 56 or 57 as well.
All right. Yeah.
So all this is happening concurrently, and along with the political situation of France being unstable and wanting to pulling out of NATO. So it would seem that somebody had clued Steinbeck in, possibly to the Priory, and their overall goal of returning a French king, or the monarchy to France as a Merovingian king. Who knows? But there are a number of similarities in the book to the Priory. And I don't necessarily think that Steinbeck was a Priory member, don't get me wrong. But if the CIA was looking over fringe groups within France and knew about the Priory of Zion, it very well could have made fodder for the Short Reign of Pepin the Fourth.
Well, they would definitely want to play on that whole mythology too, of, you know, the backdrop of that. And, you know, people in France would have at least a peripheral awareness of that. And, you know, that's, but it's amazing though, you think about all these things. You mentioned it's a game. I mean, it's a major game. We are in such a bubble of manipulation of our perception. You know, they throne and they dethrone. The whole political movements rise and fall under the achievements of, you know, keep people under their thumb, you know, under their control. I mean, you have this other example. We talked about that briefly in the break, I believe, about how even modern art was used as a CIA weapon for a while, the whole Congress for Cultural Freedom. And you have the same kind of scenario there where during the Cultural Cold War, as they call it, the CIA was part of like trying to win over European intellectuals to their side. Uh-huh. So they funded these, you know, anti-Stalinist lefties like, you know, Melvin Lasky, and, you know, there's other people involved in that. It's so bizarre when you begin to really scrape, you know, under the surface of this thing.
Exactly. And that's why it is so difficult. I know I keep saying could have been possibly, but we're looking at organizations, and this is any intelligence organization, not just the CIA, but their whole basis is deception. That's what the entire intelligence community is based on, is deception, whether it be spies being infiltrated in with cover stories. Mm. I mean, you know, they tell a person, okay, you were born X, Y, and Z, but today you are PDNF. So you take on this role, which is a lie in and of itself. So that's why it's so hard to peel back any of these layers. And I mentioned this in the book, and it's kind of like looking for extrasolar planets. You know, back in early on, before we started turning Hubble towards some of these other solar systems, we had to look for extrasolar planets by anomalies in their stars. You know, seeing the shadow pass in front of a star or other mathematical irregularities.
Being cooled, yeah.
Well, and that's kind of like what looking at intelligence agencies are like. We can't see the planet, but we can see the wake that that planet makes while going around a star.
Right.
Yeah. So we have to guess. We have to ask these questions. And even if I'm wrong about a number of these things, we still have Steinbeck offering to work for the agency, and we still have have the agency accepting his offer.
Yeah, yeah.
And the rest, these questions have to be asked. As a country, we need to ask it, because one of our cultural icons might have duped us. He might, and I believe he did that on his own terms. I don't think Steinbeck was a puppet by any stretch of the imagination. But I think he felt that the Cold War was as real a war as World War II was. You couldn't buy Cold War bonds. There was no army to join, but there sure as hell was a big threat. And how did John figure out to combat that threat? By joining the CIA and intellectually using those same lessons he'd learned with the Beach Jumpers during the Second World War. Once again, it's all part of the same big pie.
Oh, definitely. It's very interesting. And I go back to the word again, didactic. You know, it's all about, you know, imposing different things on top of it as well. What do you think kind of a lesson should be learned by something like this when it comes to, I mean, I've always questioned, you know, Brian, for example, why certain authors, you brought up Dan Brown before. I thought that whole scenario in itself of how the immense popularity that book gained and everything else. I mean, I'm not trying to say that every single aspect in our lives is a conspiracy and run by some, intelligence agency. I'm not trying to get to that either. Although the possibility is there considering all the things we've been talking about, but what kind of lesson should it teach us when it comes to these people's, you know, the champions of the people and these, you know, writers and playwrights and you know, movies that are let before us, that there's shaping our world and our morality, if you will.
In God we trust and all others pay cash.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically it. You have to look at things from every possible angle. And, you know, just because I'm saying this doesn't mean that it's accurate. You have to dig into it, and you have to look for the irregularities, and you have to look at the motivations behind anything that you read in print, see in film. And it's kind of like the old symbolism thing. You know, we can look at a picture of a 1920s cowboy with a swastika on their gloves. I think there's a Gene Autry photo of that, which doesn't mean that Gene Autry was a Nazi, because a swastika was a good luck symbol back then.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You know,
sorry to cut you off, Brian, but it's a very good point, because we use our current moral and even knowledgeable lens, you know, looking at history. And that's, in some cases, that's actually a big mistake to make. You have to look at it with the eyes of the times, right?
Exactly. You do. And especially with this, because it's really, really easy to say, oh, God, Steinbeck worked for the CIA. How horrible is that? Well, if you're younger than about 35, you can't really appreciate what it was like to grow up during the Cold War. When in 30 minutes notice, society and civilization could very literally end.
Yeah, yeah.
And with that ever-present threat.
People think today, it's a very good point. People think today that it's like, you know, they can look at someone like, you know, McCarthy or something like that and kind of laugh at them. You know, look at these idiots. You know, they're like thinking there's reds under the beds, you know. But the fact is there was a real and a true threat then. And this is, it's a disconnection that I think many people have lost. And again, so they look at history. And then try to think that, you know, that those who were kind of judged, if you will, those who were sought after, have kind of, it's almost like they've been vindicated in history. Like, you know, it wasn't that bad, you know. So it's a very tricky and delicate thing, because a lot of people are immediately ready to. I mean, I'm not saying that CIA are any saints or anything like that by far. But I'm saying there was a. If it is a real threat there, then it's an understandable function that they were filling in most cases anyway.
Exactly. And once again, the CIA is guilty of excesses. I mean, I'm not saying the CIA is you know, the Boy Scouts by any stretch of the
imagination. No, of course not. Of course not.
You know, and
far from it. Yeah.
Yeah. But in the same token, the perception of what the CIA does has to be tempered with a lot of what the mundane realities are too. And like we've been talking about, you know, it's not going out and blowing up secret volcano bases. It's a lot of stakeouts and a lot of digging through records. And, you know, there's, I'd say the vast majority of it's that, but there is that element too of that control and the spread of information or disinformation for their own purposes or what they perceive as the good of the country's purposes. And us as citizens, we have to ask these questions because as an American citizen, the CIA or any intelligence agency or the United States military are doing these things in the name of Brian Kinnard, in the name of my son. I want to know. I want to know that they're doing the right things because I have a right to. I'm funding it. I'm putting my stamp of approval on it. But if I don't have enough information to make an intelligent decision on whether I need to call my congressman or my senator, then that's a problem. But in the same token, intelligence agencies have to operate with secrecy or, you know, they're not worth beans. So I don't know where that line is, but these are the questions that we need to be asking, just like the media things that you've brought up. It all starts with asking the question.
Yeah.
Because asking the question might not lead to the right answer, but it leads to the discussion and opening your mind to the possibilities, both mundane and extraordinary, that fall anywhere in between. And you being able to say, I accept this, 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 and this, but whoa, wait a minute. This is the line I as a citizen will not cross or will not allow my government to cross. That's what the goal of that discussion should be.
And then I have to add to this as well that, you know, granted that both sides used the fear during the Cold War and played on that to you know, to create the scenario that they wanted to see fit with their own agendas and everything, and they were riding that wave. I mean, when it gets really interesting is when you, let's say, look at the work of someone like Anthony C. Sutton, you know, and the Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution and the potential creation even of this very dialect. I think very few people have been in a position where they have been could give themselves the perspective to zoom out and see that bigger picture. And I think a lot of people are well-meaning in their desire for security and safety and everything else, but in that dialectic process, they're definitely being played and used in a bigger game, you know?
Sure. And I believe that goes on even within the alternative media today. I know that I'm probably going to get crucified for this, but how do we know that some of the alternative media out there is not propaganda from the other side?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we have to be able to ask those questions, right?
Exactly. And those are the questions that a lot of people in the community just don't ask because we want to believe that our government is big and bad and the alternative media is theirs, our champions. Because, you know, in a righteous and just universe, the media in the United States should equate to truth. I know it doesn't, but that's what the gold standard is. It is our watchdog, and we have become disenchanted with mainstream media. So we've run to alternative media. Well, who's to say alternative media is all that? You know, we have to ask that question.
Well, exactly. And I think it's just only reasonable and logical actually to think that since the movement, you know, we can call it that, have gained so much, you know, attention, popularity, sure, you know, scorn and ridicule as well, but nonetheless, a lot of energy has been, you know, accumulated behind that. So it only makes sense that any political organization, a governmental organization, even, you know, secret, you know, intelligence operatives, etc., programs running under that banner would have an interest in trying to utilize that energy. That just makes sense, right?
It does to me. But the point is to be ever vigilant. And I'm not saying, once again, just like the mainstream media or any of the moving parts that we've talked about here, they're not all bad guys and they're not all good guys. But think for yourself. And that's what we have to do. And that's really a lot of the point of the book, too, is to open up your mind to the possibilities that have literally been staring people in the face for years. I mean, Steinbeck's FBI file came out in the 70s. And those CIA redactions have been sitting there in front of everybody to look at. Why I picked up on it, I don't know. My wife keeps telling me, hey, it was just your story to tell. But we have to open our eyes, and we have to look for those little things that just don't make sense and start digging at those. And, you know, we can do that ourselves.
And do you think, Brian, that everything that could be told about this story has been documented and even at that extent has been released to you?
No. And no. Here's another little interesting tidbit. For the documents that I got came with a little letter from the CIA, and it's in the book and on the website, that says, all right, here's what we got. Here's what you're getting. And this is it. We can't confirm or deny anything else. And for weeks and actually months while I was writing the book, you know, it was a little over a year between the time I got the documents and we published the book. I kept going back to the CIA's Freedom of Information Act electronic reading room to see if they were going to post this. And oddly enough, I haven't gotten any rhythm with the mainstream media in this. You know, once again, it's easy to be conspiratorial, or maybe, you know, the story's not that great. You know, decide for yourself. But anyway, supposedly I got all these documents that had a release date on them of July or August of 2012. Well, there are more documents that have surfaced on the CIA's Freedom of Information Act reading room, including the documents that I got, but have earlier release dates. So I'm not really sure what exactly that's all about, but there's something fishy going on with that. Why would the CIA release these documents?
Right.
In the first place?
Yeah, that's my question, you know?
I don't know. I wish I knew, because, you know, if I figured out one formula for success with them, maybe I can do it again. But, you know, and why deny me documents that they are going to release on their website anyway that would be pursuant to the same request? That makes me think there is a hell of a lot more to this story. And this is hopefully the tip of the iceberg. But, you know, one of the things, too, that we've touched on that I really want to bring to people's awareness is the FBI destroying some of Steinbeck's FBI file. In this digital age, there is no reason the United States government should destroy anything. Everything can be electronically filed, scanned, something. There's no reason to destroy a document whatsoever. And yet we have a historical figure, a Nobel Prize winning historical and cultural icon of this country, whose FBI file has been burned, or portions of it. That's unacceptable to me. And it should be unacceptable to the American citizens that are listening to this now, because we deserve to know, and we pay for it. So keep them. And who knows what sins they're covering up, because the process that the FBI goes through and all government agencies are set by the National Archives. And basically the National Archives says, all right, every government agency sets up a disposition of document plan. So that means that, you know, this type of document you say we keep for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, we'll go over your plan. You have a records custodian, and they decide what is a permanent record. And a permanent record is something that has historical significance. And then you contact us. We'll help you decide whether it really is a permanent record, and then we'll archive it. Well, there's nothing in the regulations that say anything about any penalty for any agencies destroying historical documents. There's nothing to say that there's oversight into looking into these documents. And it's hard for me to believe that anyone working for the Federal Bureau of Investigations doesn't know who John Steinbeck is, or Rosa Parks, or Walter Cronkite. And those stories were broken. Cronkite and Parks was broken by USA Today a number of years ago. So were these documents destroyed because they're embarrassing to the FBI? I don't care. The American public shouldn't care. The FBI sure cares, and they did nothing wrong by the law. And that steams the hell out of me. So that's another very, very salient point to all this. It is, our history is slipping away from us, and we don't even know it.
Yeah, it's being destroyed. All the records are being shredded. And I think you have that possibility as well of the, now with the immense storage capabilities and everything, that there is a lot of things that are being kept away, and there might even be records that is largely unaware of to a lot of people in the majority of the countries, that the intelligence agencies, of course, want to have as much information as they can, but they wouldn't be interested in letting that available to private researchers and journalists and everything else. So I think there's a lot of documentation that we just simply don't know about, things that haven't even been documented in the same fashion that we think of it. But those are mysteries, at this point.
Right. Exactly. And part of the whole Freedom of Information Act process, and it's a great law. I mean, I love the fact that we can go to the government and say, hey, I want this document. But that's also the rub, too. You have to know exactly what you're looking for. And how do you know exactly what to look for if you're not privy to what documentation exists?
That's so it's right.
It's kind of a chicken and egg kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it can work. And, that, once again, that's another point to all this. I'm an average Joe. And I got this information, and any other actually, I believe any person can file an FOIA claim, not only American citizens. I think that's different in the United Kingdom, but here in the States, yeah, anybody can make an FOIA request. But, and I've got an article about how to go about that at the Steinbeck Citizens File website too. It might help folks out for that, but yeah, mm-hmm. Start requesting documents.
Yeah, exactly. Find out. And, I've pointed out this before many times, but, people out there, you guys are the intelligence community, in that sense, and the eyes and the ears of formulating this loose affiliation chain, if you will, of people who are just interested in finding out the truth about history and everything else. And, and I always said it also on top of things, of course, and even because it's just on a piece of paper or documented, that doesn't make it true either. You have a falsification aspects. You have other kind of layers of propaganda underneath there. So don't believe everything that's printed on paper, guys, either. So
yeah, exactly. So, I'm just hoping that the documents they sent me weren't false.
Right.
They're not. I actually had Tom confirm that the handwriting was John's, and at least that's real. So
sure.
And believe me, I thought about that too. Or people accusing me of falsifying the documents. I mean, it's a big world and people need to ask these questions.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
And like I said, it all begins with thinking for yourself, getting off the couch, cracking a book and opening your mind up. And that's how we win. That's how civilization wins. And that's how civilization always has won. Is when the rank and file citizenry enlightens themselves. And that's the only way we can progress and beat the bad guys at whatever their game is.
Very good. Some excellent points on this story, Brian. Think, analyze, question. Well done on the book, of course, and this fascinating insight. You know, is there anything else you want to add to this? Of course, I want to give you again the opportunity to give out the websites and the details about how to get the book. But if there's anything else you want to round things up on, please go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just do that. If you're interested in the book, you can go to www.steinbeckcitizenspy.com, and that's, once again, got the salient documents. It's got a number of articles there, links to intelligence agencies and intelligence resources, Freedom of Information Act resources, even if you're interested in Steinbeck himself, a number of links there. And as we get more information, it will be posted there too. And if you're an aspiring author, I own a publishing company called Grave Distractions Publications. We've published, gosh, I believe it's 60 books over the last 4 years, with and worked with 20 or so different authors. And we offer traditional publishing plans as well as non-traditional. So whatever kind of help you need, drop me an email. And all that contact information is at www.gravedistractions.com. And I appreciate you having me on.
Grave Distractions, and then we have Steinbeck Citizen Spy. Good stuff. Thank you so much for your time today, Brian. We really appreciate it. Good show. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, some interesting information from Brian here on John Steinbeck. I hope you enjoyed it and learned some new aspects to this. We'll be back in just a few days with Freeman. Then we have Mike Mitchum, Andreas Buckmeyer, Judy Byington, Jesse Ventura, Louise Proud, John Whitehead, Richard Hoagland, and Anthony P. So stay with us for much more. But for today, we say thank you for listening and thank you for being a member. For Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, John, and myself, we say have a good rest of your day or evening, and we'll speak to you soon. Take care.